long time, you're too late in the game. So when I hear those things, you know, that's a challenge for me. So I'm like, you know, why are you trying to tell me no? Why do I have to go to the auxiliary businesses when I know that I can grow? I've been, you know, I come from my grandparents are farmers, my wife's parents are farmers. So we have that on our DNA. Why can I grow the hemp myself and start my own business myself instead of, you know, volunteering and working for other people? And that's how we started.
Hey guys, it's Mandy with Global Hemp Association. I wanted to say thank you so much for joining. I'm excited about the opportunity to build a relationship and connect this supply chain. I mean, after all, that's why we started the association. Our association was built on the foundation of connecting supply chain, building relationships, and helping you grow your business. Anyone from farmers, manufacturers, and distributors, people that are passionate about the supply chain, and those creating products selling into biofuels, plastics, textiles, construction, and building materials.
Hello, hello.
Hey, everybody. How are you doing, Mandy?
Good morning. I really want to give a shout out to everybody that's listening. Let us know where you're chiming in from. Say hello. Hit subscribe on our YouTube channel. We're really doing a drive to get our YouTube subscribers up so that we can open up new opportunities for ourselves and for you guys to connect and communicate. So please go in and subscribe. And then if you hear anything that you like in today's call, please chime in. We'd love to hear from you. Feel free to ask any questions. Hector's a rock star, so I'm really excited about this call. I'm excited I got to know you a little bit over at NOCO and got to spend some time together. And so that's pretty exciting. Hector, why don't you real quick tell me before we get started, where did freedom come from?
Oh, so the way I got into the cannabis, you know, to the cannabis industry, you could say, was through podcasting. And that's my stage name, I say, Freedom. So on the podcast, I go by Freedom. And a lot of people in the industry, in the hemp or the marijuana industry, they know me by Freedom. not a lot of people know me by Hector. So that's why I put that there.
Okay, very cool.
And the name of the podcast is Blue Dream Radio. So if anybody want to go see it, like the strain, Blue Dream, that was my favorite one back in the day. That's what I started smoking. That's why I named it after it.
Blue Dream Radio. Okay. So tell me a little bit about your background, how you got into this industry. What brought you to where you're at now?
Well, again, I wear many different hats. I'm a community activist. I come from a union background. So I've been, you know, an activist in different spaces for a long time. So, you know, the way I started in the industry was through the podcasting. And then, you know, I've been organizing unions. I know the ins and outs of how to mobilize people to fight for a cause, to be a voice for the voiceless. So I'm used to, you know, leadership development and training people. So the transition was kind of easy for me because, you know, you have to be an advocate to be in this industry. You cannot just be a business person or try to make money. You have to be an advocate because the laws need to change so we can push our movement forward. So you have to be an advocate. You have to be engaged in what's going on in your district, in your city, in your state, in your town, wherever you are. You have to be engaged. So that's how I got into it. But through our podcast, Blue Dream Radio, my wife and I, because she's the co-host, we decided not to talk about the lifestyle. We decided to talk about equity and how the industry from hemp to marijuana and psychedelics has been entrenched with racist laws. So we, you know, want to expose that and start those conversations. How can people of color, BIPOC farmers, BIPOC people in different communities can create generational wealth through this through these industries that's popping up now, the hemp, marijuana, that is, you know, basically they put us in jail for it. A bunch of white people made billions of dollars. Now it's legalizing all over the place and we're still in jail for it and we being left out of the business. So for us, we wanted to expose that through our podcast. And then I started volunteering in different farms here in Connecticut because I live in Connecticut and I have a farm myself here in Connecticut, Cimarron Farmstead. And I started, you know, volunteering in different farms. And then I decided, you know, one day I can do this myself. So I started researching, how can I buy land? How can I acquire land so I can do this myself and teach others how to do it? And, you know, everybody used to tell me, you know, before I got my farm, you know, you're crazy. There's people that's been farming cannabis and hemp for a long time. You're too late in the game. So when I hear those things, you know, that's a challenge for me. So I'm like, you know, why are you trying to tell me no? Why do I have to go to the ancillary businesses when I know that I can grow? I've been, you know, I come from my grandparents are farmers. My wife's parents are farmers. So we have that on our DNA. Why can I grow the hemp myself and start my own business myself instead of, you know, volunteering and working for other people? And that's how we started. To me, when I hear the challenge, somebody telling me, no, you can't do that, I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it because I know I can do it well. And I know that I can learn. And I know I can make something good out of it and teach people out of it because that's our priority on our farm. Because we don't grow hemp. We always say that we are, hemp is one of the crops that we grow. So we grow vegetables. We got an apiary. We're going to get some chickens and some goats soon. So we, you know, we incorporate hemp because we are a regenerative farm. So we believe in regenerative practices. We are farming in Pegasic land because a lot of these rooms, they don't acknowledge the indigenous people that came before us because, you know, the land that you are farming on don't belong to you, even though your name is on the deed. That farm, that piece of land do not belong to you, belong to indigenous people. So that's why we always pay homage to those people because it's necessary. So we farming on stolen land on 3 acres. We are farming on a quarter acre right now. So we have a grow of 300 plants for CBD right now. And now, you know, being involved, really involved in the industry. This is going to be my last year growing for CBD. You know, I want to grow for fiber. I want to find land. Anybody that's in Connecticut that want to team up with me, that have land, that want to build some good infrastructure and build something good, you know, reach out to me because I'm looking for that. You know, to acquire more land or work with others so we can grow hemp and fiber. So the way I started was, you know, I just decided one day with my wife, we're going to be farmers, the pandemic hit, we got to be sustainable, and why not buy land and do it?
Good job. Good job. Okay, so talk to me about some of the real challenges, not just as the, you know, ethnicity and the, you know, BIPOC, you know, cultural concept. What about also in the farming aspect, you know, being new and being boots on the ground and hands in the soil? Talk to me about some of the real challenges that you've seen and now been able to overcome.
I mean, it's just understanding the land. Again, this is our, we've been farmers for a while, for about 8-10 years, but we were farming, urban farming. So we come from New York City. So we were farming on our fire escape. I used to be, you know, on the DL, I used to grow some, you know, some plants here and there. So I've been a farmer. You know, I went to Oxenham University to learn. I don't know if you guys know what Oxenham University, I'm putting a plug there. Oxenham University, they are one of the first educational places for marijuana in Oakland. So they teach people how to grow weed. They teach them the law, they teach them the ins and outs. You know, they teach you how to be a grower. So I went over there. I learned as much as I could. But, you know, learning how to do it and doing it is two different things, especially when you're doing it in an open field. So for me, growing in 3 acres, I didn't know that deer like hemp so much. So, you know, I had 200 plants last year and the deer ate it all. So now we put in, you know, fencing, deer fencing all over. Because they were getting, you know, there's an archer a few hundred feet away. So they were getting drunk and high at the same time. And they were eating all the apples that was, you know, on the floor of the rotten apples.
They were so happy.
Yeah, they were, you know, probably
sleeping good.
So for us, that was one of the challenges is, you know, we didn't know that we had to put deer fence, and we have a hoop house, but we never put it up because we were, you know, it was when we started, it was almost the end of the season. So we wanted to see what we can grow. So we planted it and the deer ate it. So that was like one challenge for me. Also irrigation, finding the right, you know, equipment to water plants, because it's easy when you're doing an indoors and you're doing a 3 plants, 4 plants, and you take a cup and you water your plants. But when you're doing 200 plants, 300 plants, you know, that it takes a lot of manual labor to do it one by one, you know, spraying. So you have to, you know, do the irrigation. So learning all these different things, because we didn't know as much as we thought we knew. Sure. So we had to learn with the land and had to learn as we go. But learning a lot, reading a lot of books, and books are good, but again, you can read all you want, but once you're in it, that's where the challenge begins, you know.
I get that. Okay, so what's this transition? You know, you're switching now from CBD, hemp for CBD, to fiber production. Why? What was your aha moment and drives that?
I just understand that I'm a climate activist too. So I was in my past life, I was a climate organizer, a climate justice organizer. So I was in the street fighting for climate justice. And okay. For me as a farmer is, how can we talk about, you know, regenerative and we're not really being regenerative? So for me, even though CBD can regenerative, create regenerative practices for our land, I see that CBD is being saturated right now. There's not a visible market for me, viable market for me in the CBD. And I see that building materials and the animal feeds and the different uses for the plant. You can take the root and turn it into tea if you have insomnia. So the innovation of hemp to me was the one that drove me away from CBD and go for the fiber and the building materials, because you can do so much and you can help the earth. And for me, it's all about climate justice. How can we change the way we are going towards in the United States? Because other countries are already doing it. A lot of people that you have in this lives, they're already talking about, you know, how other countries are moving forward with hemp, and we are the ones stuck still with the concrete, with the oil, drilling. Instead of using all the things that hemp can do, we are still stuck. So for me, it's like pushing that forward. That's for me, that was like the aha moment. You know, if we're talking about climate justice, if we're talking about regenerative, we got to use the whole plant. And that's why moving away from even marijuana. I don't even want to be in the marijuana industry anymore, because the marijuana industry, first, is not for Black people. They it's already made up. It's not made for us.
What do you mean?
Oh, the marijuana industry, like right now in Connecticut, we're going to talk Connecticut because that's where I'm at.
Yeah.
There's only 2 equity licenses, and there's like hundreds of applications coming in for 2 equity cultivation licenses. To me, that's predatory. To me, they use equity very loosely. It's just an algorithm. You know about algorithms. So to me, that's an algorithm word that people use here and there just because they need, you know, some votes. So, you know, that's what they're pushing over here. 2 equity license. Thousands of people are going to apply. You need millions of dollars in the bank. And I'm not about that life. I'm not going to, you know, go to a business where it's about longevity and the people that are already making money, like the Curaleaf, TerraPlant, and all these big MSOs in the marijuana industry already have the longevity money. I don't have the money to compete. You know, they're gonna buy me out.
There's a lot of red tape in the industry, yeah. Right? Yeah.
Yeah. So, and for me, it was easier to get into the hemp industry. Like the USDA here in Connecticut, they want you to grow hemp. Like when I was filling out my application, I had a few mistakes, but they kept calling me. They walked me through it. They said, we want you to grow hemp and we're going to help you however we can. So for me, it was more welcoming, you know, the hemp, was more welcoming than the marijuana industry, because, you know, it's always, you know, that red tape. If you don't have the money, the more money you got, the more chances you got to make it in the industry, unless you are embedded with the MSOs, the multi-state operators, for people that don't know, in Connecticut in the marijuana industry. And then I get to meet people like you guys in the hemp industry. So for me, you know, going to NOCO was like an eye experience to see all these different people there doing this type of work that are not being, the hemp is still in its infancy, and we're not being, you know, we don't have the clout that marijuana has, and we need to get that because this is the future, and we moving the future forward. And that's the only way for us to see a better tomorrow here in the United States.
Totally. Okay, so you said something earlier about sustainability in the marijuana industry and where your passion is around the sustainability and regenerative agriculture and mm-hmm. you know, better farming practices. What I'm learning about the marijuana industry is it is not sustainable.
No, it's not.
You know, it is very, its footprint, carbon footprint is pretty hefty.
Yeah, I mean, and because when you do it indoors and you have to have, you know, you're using electricity. A lot of these big spaces don't have solar panels, so they got to use electricity. Some of them use gas. The process of extraction, all of that. Not to say that, you know, it might not, you know, some people might not do that in the hemp industry, but I think that if we're doing it right, I think that we have a lesser chance to create so much climate pollution as the marijuana industry.
Oh yeah. Well, especially the amount of biomass and the amount of, you know, carbon that's being sequestered even above the ground.
Yeah. Right? Okay, so for me, that's a big thing about hemp farming is carbon sequestration. So for me, it's just, you know, creating those opportunities because this is a big conversation about carbon credits. So for me, I'm interested in that. I don't know much about it, but, you know, I'm learning as I go why it's important for us to start thinking about this type of strategies for farmers. That's how you're going to get farmers to grow. Because one of the problems here in Connecticut is that they push in hemp, but we don't have no processing, especially for fiber, especially for seeds. We have a few extraction companies here in Connecticut for CBD. But there's 97 hemp farmers in total. So you have to wait in a line. So how can we start pushing these politicians, start pushing the USDA, and start pushing people in the East Coast as a whole, that we need processing, that we need to build more and create more land available for fiber to be grown with hemp and create processing, because that's what we lack. And that's the fight that I have right now. I do some consulting as well. So right now I'm consulting 100 acres upstate New York, and they want to go that route. They don't want to grow CBD. They want to grow for fiber. They want to do processing. So how can we bring the processing to the East Coast? Because we need that. And that's the plan. I'm organizing people around the East Coast so we can start pushing that ball forward because we need processing here. There's no point to push the hemp if we don't have no processing and we don't have no market for it, because that's the other side of the coin, is that we can have the processing, we can have the acreage of hemp, but if we don't have a market where people are buying it and we're not doing the demonstration and teaching people that they need to move away from these old practices and move towards hemp and buy hemp, it doesn't matter how much processing plants we have and how many acreages we grow, because farmers need money at the end of the day. They need to see the viability of the crop that they are growing.
Hey, how have you thought about what, from your perspective as a farmer, what would be the ideal layout of processing?
For me, it's having the contracts ready.
And when I mean, as far as like, do you set up silos, like grain silos, where people bring product in? Do you set up huge processing? Is it community-based processing? You know, because then when we look at scalability for large contracts, mm-hmm. it's got to drive the end market, right? Where, Yeah, what's your perspective?
I see we should create centralized places where people can go and create and make it easier for people to drive their products to you or you pick it up. But having for me, I live in Connecticut, right? So you have Waterbury, you have Bridgeport. Those were industrial cities that had, you know, industrial plants that were doing many different things, and now they're abandoned. So even on that aspect, you can, you know, rehabilitate a whole community like Waterbury, like Bridgeport, if you bring some of this processing to those places and turn those empty facilities into processing facilities for hemp. You can also create trade schools around hemp. How can you process and create something with the plant? Because you have many different uses for the hemp plant. It's not just building materials. You can do so much. So teaching this trade to our younger generation, because I'm also a youth organizer. I have a nonprofit in the South Bronx. I'm the executive director of One Freedom for All. And we do food insecurity. Yeah, One Freedom. food insecurity and ending the school to prison pipeline, police-free schools. So if you're in New York and in New Jersey and Connecticut, you know that our high schools, public high schools, are flooded with police officers and metal detectors that feel like they are in a jail. So you can see an actual pipeline of them pushing our young people out of jail, into jail, out of schools, into jail. And a lot of our young people that we work with, and that's one of the reasons why we are moving, changing some of our work to gear towards cannabis, is because a lot of the young people that we work with, they've been arrested for cannabis, for smoking weed, and now they cannot go to college because once you have a record, you cannot get financial aid. You cannot get federal funding for your college. So for us, that's a fight. So how can we teach our young people, because everything about cannabis and hemp is the children. So how can we teach our young people a new trade, teaching about how to consume it at the right age and healthy, in the healthy ways, and actually do some education for our young people so they can, you know, they can be part of this new industry that is for them. So for me, it's like I'm leaving this stuff for the young generation. I have 3 kids. So for me, it's leaving that for them. So how can we train our young people to learn a new trade? And you can do all of that through, you know, creating these silos, these places where people can learn what the hemp plant is.
Sure. What's available acreage in your area? Like both BIPOC, you know, acreage or farmland, as well as available that's scalable.
Well, in Connecticut, 98% of all farmland is owned by white people.
Holy cow, really?
So, and that's just in Connecticut, but 95%, I'm sorry, 95% of farmland in Connecticut is owned by white folks. Yeah. In the nation, 98% of all farmland, and this is USDA, the USDA, they do every 3 years, they do their census, and this is per the 2017 census. 98% of all farmland is owned by white landowners. So, like, we don't have, you know, 1% of all farmers are black. So, for me, it's like, you know, when we're talking about farming as a whole, that's just hemp. Hemp, not a lot of people's growing hemp, but when we're talking about farming, we don't own anything. We are leasing, or, you know, if you're lucky, you buy a quarter acre. We were lucky to buy 3 acres. We feel privileged, you know, to be able to do that, because a lot of people don't have that. But a lot of us farmers of color have to lease farm to be able to farm. And for us, it's that also. As a farm as a whole, it's land access. How can we create more land access to BIPOC farmers that want to get into this trade? Because you still need the land to farm it. And we have the knowledge. Don't get it twisted. They brought slaves to this country for farming. That's the only reason why they brought us here, because they knew that we knew farming. Our black women, when they were being brought over here, they put the seeds in their hair so they can transfer some of those seeds from their native land to the new world. So they brought us here for farming. So, and now we're being excluded on all facets of agriculture in this country.
Okay, so what are some solutions? What are some suggestions on solutions, right? Especially every time you talk, I feel like the smart commodities, climate smart commodities grant that's coming out is really geared towards helping this problem, right? Or feeding, you know, solutions. How do you roll that out? What do you suggest?
I'm a solution based. I always point out the problem, but I'm always solution based. And for me, it's like, again, it's uniting, understanding the issue, and uniting, coming and having these conversations. And, you know, I might have some thoughts about it, but if we come together and we create a unified front and we create a unified solution that we all say we behind this, it doesn't matter if you're black and white, if you fit, you know, this criteria, if you know that you've been marginalized, that you've been oppressed by, you know, messed up laws, you know, because I have a lot of friends that have been arrested and they're white for cannabis too. You know, they fit the criteria. Not all white people, you know, have it easy. So I understand that too. You know, I'm 38 years old. So I've traveled all over this nation organizing non-union workers. So I went to Yakima, Washington, and, you know, trailer parks. And, you know, those people there, they needed the same thing. They just, you know, as soon as I broke that racism barrier, they just like regular people, just like us. You know, they need that problem. Yeah. That's when I understood money. So for us, the solution is, you know, people going into their to talk to their politicians, join as many different associations as you can. Join the Global Hemp Association. Please. Your tribe. You know, create so that's how you create solutions. Go to your politicians, call them and say, we want this. Create a new policy. You know, be part of the Democratic Party in your town, so you can start crafting new policy around hemp. I just became part of the Hemp Building Association. So they right now they are fighting with the New York, so they can include hempcrete in the coding for building. So getting into that fight, like, you know, pushing that, you know, posting if you are.
Supporting it. Okay, good.
Yeah.
Okay, keep going.
I don't know what was the last thing you heard. I don't know what was the last thing you heard.
You would ask, and of course I would forget. I tried to talk a couple of times, and I was like, oh, I can't yet. So of course I lost my train of thought too. I don't know. I don't know where you left off. I'm sorry.
No, I'm just saying, like, you know, with solutions. So for me also is that, is using these empty buildings that you see, like in Waterbury, Bridgeport, and put them to use. To me, that's like, you know, that's a way for, you know, to create those green jobs that we all talking about. But go ahead. I know you.
No, I remembered what you were saying. We were talking about Hemp Builders Association and them bringing their project up to DC to be certified or somewhere to be certified. And I just saw Jacob posted something great about that. And so I think it was a success. And they've been doing great things. They've got a great team and they're working hard. Yeah. They're awesome and they're making progress. So it's fun to watch.
Yeah. I mean, and also just find your own solutions. If somebody tells you this is happening, you know, create your own, like find your tribe, your group, create your own groups and build, because it's all about having the conversation and, you know, not forgetting. Cause one thing for me and in Connecticut in particular, cause now I live here, I don't want to be part of the cannabis industries, even if I have the marijuana industry, even if I have a chance, is because they purposely excluded a native nation. The Eastern Pequots are state recognized, not federally recognized. So they made a compact deal with the federal recognized tribes. So they can, you know, pay the state whatever they have to pay the state, but they have a full autonomy on their marijuana and hemp operations. But they excluded the Eastern Pequot. So how I'm going to be trying to make some money in Connecticut when they excluded people that are direct descendant of the Mystic Massacre? That's why they name, you know, Thanksgiving. If people know the history, when they kill all this indigenous life in Mystic, they call it, they name the Thanksgiving after that. So they direct descendant of these people, and you excluding them. So, and I work with this, and I work with them. I'm like, you know, we found each other for some, you know, for some reason, and now we build an alliance. So now we're working together. So if you excluding them, what's going to happen to me? And this is the people that's, you know, that this land belongs to. You growing cannabis in the, on their land, and you excluding them. So for me, that was like, you know, I leave it to the people that want to, you know, that want that blood money.
Yeah. Well, it, what's amazing to me is this is still happening. And I'm a little bit embarrassed to admit how naive I was to it. I just, it's not in my face, and it wasn't in my face. And it's, it infuriates me. It just bothers me that there's, and it, I see it everywhere. Right? We see it come up in all parts of business. Mm-hmm. And that's where it gets so discouraging is why? What are the, yeah, what are the solutions? How do we change it? So I'm curious about how do we get, how do we create that opportunity, right? For, I don't know how to ask this. As opportunities are opening up for, revenue and processing and job and land ownership, right? How do we prepare, or what is the information that new farmers need to hear in order to be prepared to start an adventure like this, or do something like this? When you say you're going out, you know, and you're talking and you're educating, you know, what are some of those key aspects that need to be evaluated or educated on?
For me, it's the longevity that some people, you know, they're thinking about right now.
Okay.
So educating them that hemp is a long-term solution. It's not a right now solution, and we got to be patient, and you got to get in it now so you can start learning. You know, listen to different people talk about hemp. Go to Winona, you know, Winona from Winona Hemp in Minnesota. Learn from her. Ladue, you know, she's great. So start like researching right now. Like I did a whole viability and feasibility study for one of my clients. So that took that for me, even though I was doing this for a client, for me that was a learning experience because I learned so much of the viability and the feasibility of hemp. And the key is finding that market. And how can we create that market? So when you have that understanding and you have that knowledge and you know, start making those connections, you start going to different conferences and you start talking to people that are like-minded like you, then you start coming up with those solutions for the market. Because at the end of the day, we all want to make some money. So we got to make this market work. So how can we create the supply and demand? The supply can be created, but the demand is the key. So how can we, as a whole, new farmers, old farmers in this industry can come up with those solutions? So coming, you know, talking to people and understanding that when what you're getting into is not going to be easy, but it's there because it's happening all over the country, all over the world. It's just not happening here, but it's happening all over the world.
It's getting there. Okay, so talk to me about demand, right? Consumer demand. If you painted a perfect picture for a consumer demand campaign, what would that look like?
For me, it would be having demonstrations. Like, you know, right now I'm working with our botanical garden. So we can get, they want to grow some hemp so they can do demonstration to builders, to trade unions. That's how we make the demand, is educating the stakeholders, because they don't understand it yet. So bringing them in a room, bringing them in a room like NOCO, cause I know in Denver, the governor is very pro hemp. I understand that he was the one that said, okay, to the hotel, you got to give them the same price because we're doing this. So you got to give them the same price. So I know changing the minds like that of the stakeholders. I'm bringing them to the spaces so they can learn what we're doing. In Troy, New York, right now, you know, that they found rebar. from hemp. So they created the rebar, the first rebar in Troy, New York, the Institute. So having those demonstrations so they can learn that we can move away from digging in the soil, digging for oil, and doing all these different things that we don't need to be doing that's detrimental to the earth, and start hailing our mother nature because we need to. So that's the way that we're going to be able to build the demand, is that if we change those stakeholders, those companies that's coming in to New York and Connecticut doing this massive buildings and infrastructures, we need to put them in a room and teach them that they need to switch to hemp. And it's not going to be easy. It's going to be, you know, it's going to be hard. People, you might want to give up. But at the end of the day, if we're not doing this work, they're not going to be doing it, because they still don't understand it after, you know, 4 or 5 years of hemp being legal in the country. They still don't understand it, why it's necessary, because there's still states that haven't legalized hemp to this day. They're still fighting to legalize hemp, you know. So
there's a lot of gray area still, right? That that really prevents a lot of things moving forward, especially as we're seeing a lot of like alternative ways to turn CBD or other cannabinoids into molecules get you high. I don't know how to not call them all out, but yes, you know. And so I like THCO or Delta 8 or any of those, that creates a big like misunderstanding of what hemp is. And it's almost like we're having to recreate that understanding that, you know, hemp is carbon sequestration, hemp is jobs, hemp is, you know, looking at this from an economic standpoint, job creation, trades, you know, really impacting where the BIPOC community is really, could really use resources, in my opinion, right? Just of what you said, like being able to really put jobs and land and new facilities and ownership and, you know, entrepreneurship back in the hands of Americans. And
like, I mean, some young people don't even know how to write a check yet. So to me, it's like, you know, that education, how you want them to run a business, a hemp business, if they don't even know how to write a check, how are they even going to create a business plan? So having, like somebody said, Patrick, you know, ancillary businesses. So like teaching these young people, teaching the community, that it's not just the cultivation, that you have many different ways to get into this industry, that you can create generational wealth. And it's all like, you know, one of the things that we want to do upstate with this 100 acres that we're consulting is that we want to build out of hemp, build a trade school there. Yeah. We bring people from the city, upstate, bring people that are on the verge of incarceration, young people, people that are coming out of jail, teaching them this trade. Because if you want them to, you know, not to, what's the word, recidivism? Recidivism, when you go back and back to jail.
Yeah.
So if you want to stop that, then you got to create opportunities. And it's all about, that's what we all about. Cimarron Farmstead, Blue Dream Radio, One Freedom for all our businesses that we have, it's all about creating opportunities for the community at large, especially for us, but also for everybody, not just for the BIPOC community, even though we're concentrating on our own.
Well, look, it's like we a ripple. Open up. Just ripples. Absolutely. Well, and that's what's so exciting, right? As you look at putting a processing facility in, and a processing facility or acres of farmland, and just the carbon, you know, aspect, let alone all of the ancillary businesses that are created because of it or impacted because of it. Like, that's where, like, there's not a lot of conversation that goes into, or we're not talking about a lot of that conversation, because we don't have a lot of active processing facility to say, look, we are doing it. Everyone's talking about it, but here we actually are. And so I really hope, I'm really excited that this, you know, grant money comes down for agriculture and the impact that it has, because it really is about farmers, and it really is about securing, that's where our supply chain starts. You know, we have outsourced so much of it and lost so much of it to, you know, other countries and other regions. And so it's great to bring it back. Okay, so tell me about
and one thing to add, one thing is also is, you know, a lot of people are here talking about ecosystem. Let's build an ecosystem around the industry. And a lot of people leave the plant, leave the actual thing that we are fighting for, that a lot of people got locked up for, that's not part of the ecosystem. I'm like, how can you not have an ecosystem without the earth or the cannabis?
The input. Right.
You cannot have it. So when we talk about ecosystem, we got to include the earth and the plant into it.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and it's a different, you know, there aren't very many other industries where the farmer is also the manufacturer and the business owner, right? Mm. That's not as common. I don't think it is, or at least that's what I see, right? Is we see a lot of, especially in the emerging industry, right? That we get a lot of the same people doing the same things and realizing what scale looks like and partnering up with those, but having to respect where the plant's coming from, and respect that it is the input and it is this Achilles tendon to all of these other, you know, pieces of the supply chain or of the industry that create revenue.
Yeah, and we need to care about what we put inside, because it's given us so much. The earth has given us so much that we need to care what we're putting in it. So, and we need to now take ownership and take responsibility of what's happened, because we, you know, we wash our hands, you know, monocropping, you know, big agro farms that are taking over thousands of acres that are doing, you know, corn and that, you know, detrimental when you grow it so much in one spot, you know, cotton. So for me, it's like, how can we move away from that and, you know, care about the small farmers and not care so much about, even though, you know, we need big farmers, but we need the small mom and pop shops like ours to survive as well, because we, you know, we are the backbone of farming for sure.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Okay, so earlier when you were talking about feasibility studies, that term is thrown around a lot, especially as people are trying to figure out, you know, what's possible with hemp. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about what do you consider in a feasibility study? What are you calculating and looking at? What do you, yeah.
So when we do a feasibility plan, we're calculating how in the long term, we're calculating the things that you can do right now as well. We're calculating
what kind of things?
Like the things that you can do right now. Like right now, one of the things that we told our client is that they can start right now selling seedlings. They can, you know, they don't have to even grow the whole plant. You can, a lot of people are just buying the seedlings and the little hemp trees. They just buying that. A lot of people are just buying seeds. So find the things that's happening right now that you can get into so you can plan for the long term. So you can have something going right now so you can go for the long term. You know, bedding, animal bedding is selling right now. So how can you, you know, sell for the first year so you can learn how to grow it, sell animal bedding, and what's the market for it right now? And a lot of places upstate where they are, they're in Camden, New York, they do a lot of cattle. So how can you start building those relationships? That's part of the feasibility plan. All the different entities that surround you, what are they doing? And how can you connect with those people so you can help better their infrastructure, and they can help you with your infrastructure. So that's all part of the plan that we put in, and also the numbers. You know, how much money you're gonna make for each product that you can produce through hemp. So that's some of the things that we include in a feasibility plan. It took us you know, I thought it was going to be 3 pages when we said, like, oh, it's going to be 3 pages. Don't worry about it. It's going to be easy. Turned out to be 26.
Yeah, it's not. Everything.
After everything, it was like a big document that has, you know, a lot of the information that you need. We also added you guys into it. Like if you really want to be part of this industry, you need to be affiliated with people that's doing this work. With people that's already have the connections to this. I also put Santa Fe Farms, but I know they changed the name.
Yeah.
And that's what we put on the viability and visibility plan. People that's already in the process of doing it or doing it already here in the United States or abroad. And that's some of the elements that we added to our to our study.
It's funny you say elements. So Santa Fe Farms turned to element six dynamics.
So. Oh, there you go. Yes.
It was right on the tip of your tongue.
That's right.
That's awesome.
But it's important to do that before you venture into this business. I feel that if you have in hand, you have, if you know exactly what you're getting into, now you have something tangible that you can make decisions on. Also, you can use that for investors. When you create a visibility story, study or viability study, you go to your investors and say, listen, you know, I did the work. This is what's happening. This is how we're going to make money. And you have this study that you can, you know, shop around now to build your infrastructure, because you need, you know, many different things that you need. You need the transportation. How are you going to get the hemp to your facility? If you trying to get a facility, where are you going to get the seeds? Because a lot of people were getting seeds from Russia, and that's not happening no more. So you need to know all these different things, and that's what goes into it. And that's what investors want to see, that you, when you really about the work that you're trying to do, you have to come prepared.
Okay, so out of your feasibility study, where in your area do you see the best opportunity? Like, what is some low-hanging fruit and some long-term real opportunity? Because I understand very well that, you know, farm really has to be close to where it's being processed or manufactured for it to really make the biggest impact. So what's leaving your area? What manufacturing's near you? And
well, there's no manufacturing near us right now, because the thing about the East Coast, especially New York, Connecticut, New Jersey, that we grow for CBD. There's not too many farmers that are growing hemp, that are growing for fiber and for seeds.
But they're processing for things like automotive or.
I mean, yeah.
I don't know. I'm asking.
No.
What are those in processing?
Right here, what we process in Connecticut, I don't think we process it. Like we do a lot of cattle. We do a lot of meat.
Okay.
And vegetables. We do a lot of meat and vegetables here in Connecticut. Not so much, you know, they do processing for meat.
That's a huge market, right? That's
so. I mean, I don't know, how can we use processing machines from cattle to process hemp? Can you do that?
No, I was meaning for supply chain. Like, if we're looking at our full supply chain, what's driving your industry?
Bedding. That's what I said. Yeah, animal bedding and animal feed. Yeah. Because there's a lot of cattle here. So for us, that's one of the things that we point out to our clients is that animal bedding, food, and CBD seedlings. Because a lot of farmers don't want to do the whole seed to harvest. They want to just buy the clones, buy the plants, you know, at a certain height, so they can just automatically just put it in their fields. So for us, that's a viable market. You have 100 acres. You just build a greenhouse designated just for seedlings, and you sell that, you know, and a lot of farmers will buy that. Because
I agree. That sounds like so much work. My facial expression is like, that's so much work.
And the long term for me is the building materials and the oils, the bio,
biobutanol and biodiesel and biofuel
for jets, for cars. And, you know, we had the conversation a few months back that, you know, BMW is going hemp. All these different clothing companies are growing hemp. Gap, you know, all these different places are going towards hemp. So, you know, starting those conversations now, talking to those reps from those companies, you know, start building those relationships. And that's what we tell our clients, is that, you know, we're going to give you a list of all the places that you can start building relationships. But no, this is, you know, long term when it comes to those materials. But if you want something right now, you know, right now in Connecticut, the big thing is, you know, any farm that you go, a lot of farmers are going, you know, the hemp route for for bedding for their animals, you know, for goats and for food. Instead of hay, they give them hemp to eat. So, you know, that's what I see. Well, we should go.
The studies are showing it, right? The studies are everywhere.
So, and when people say there's no viable business or no feasible business, there is. You just got to know where to find them.
Sure. What do you mean? When you say that, what do you mean?
A lot of people say there's no viability in hemp right now.
Oh, yeah.
That you should not be, that people should not get into hemp because you're not going to make any money. But if you're a hustler, if you like, you know, innovative, and that's one of the reasons why I love hemp, because you have to be innovative. You have to think. You have to
use your head. And we're at the forefront of this. This is where opportunities lies, right? And these people that are at the forefront driving the industry like yourself are who going to make it in the industry. No, and it's unfortunate the CBD. I had a really good interview last week with Josh Hendricks about, and he put into perspective for me the term, you know, CBD crash, right? Like understanding the numbers and understanding how little actually needs to be grown to hit market demand and how gray, you know, our market still was with the FDA, you know, in business, we've got to be wise about it. Mm-hmm. And same back. Farming is a business, right? And we've got to be smart in business, and we can't jump in and not evaluate the entire supply chain and being able to see, you know, what's driving our end market. What do contracts look like? What do our agreements look like? And
not meant to mention droughts, not to mention if you go through, through a drought as a farmer, then your crop is so messed up. You get a fungus, or you get some bad mold or bad infestation, and your whole crop for that year.
Or deer.
There you go. That's your crop. So you got to think about all those different things. So, yeah.
Yeah. And so those are the types of things that, you know, we need to consider when we're growing business and what business looks like. And so when I asked earlier, you know, how do we get funds or how do we get opportunity to these farmers that are owed opportunity, right? That's kind of where I'm at. You know, what are some of those filters, if you call it, or some of those processes that we can put in place to help educate them? And I really like some of the topics we talked about. I'd love to revisit them, you know, at a later date and see if we can, you know, nail down some of the top three questions, and let's do a Q&A and just dive into those top three questions. And so we can start getting content to specifically probably answer a lot of questions you're getting.
No, and right now, like, you know, I'm part of different, I'm part of the DEI working groups that the Department of Ag has put together. Like every state are putting these working groups together. So I'm part of the education working group. So one of the things that we are working on is to put a centralized place where new beginning farmers can learn about how can they get land access. What are some of the different tactics for regenerative agriculture that you can use? What are some of the things that you can grow? What is hemp? And one of the things that I'm pushing is to have a whole conversation for new beginning farmers about the possibilities of hemp and how can we create generational wealth through it. So that's some of the things that we are pushing, is educational places where are meaningful education, not just to educate people, but actually we're going to education and then we're going to put you in a place where you can get hands-on experience and maybe become owner of something of your own. But at least you can get, you know, the practice, you can get the hands-on experience, work with different farmers that is doing this work, and create an actual leadership line where you can see these new farmers growing, you know, within the community.
And have the tools, you know, this toolbox I want to be able to provide for them. And with that comes those vetted connections that you can trust, that are doing things right, that have good intentions. And yeah, absolutely.
And if we can make $30 billion available that Biden just signed for, you know, and I don't have nothing against the police, but if they have $30 billion for the police and like $700 and something for the army, they should put some money towards agriculture and toward people that, you know, are in need here in the United States. Like some of that money should like be reallocated to the needs of the United States as a whole, because a lot of people are losing their homes. A lot of people are losing their jobs. And we need to, you know, reallocate and rethink how we use money in this country.
Yeah, I'm really hoping that we are not a disappointment in the way money is allocated or distributed for this climate smart commodity, mm-hmm. right? They really are focused on, or from what I've read, is our farmer and getting money into the hands of the farmer. And with that comes having to build some infrastructure so that we can support the offtake of those farmers, right? Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think I'm really hoping that, you know, with all of the efforts, and not just in the hemp industry, it's all agriculture, right? Everybody, but focused on kind of the topics we talked about today. And so
I would like for them not to take it back, because, you know, the USDA put $5 billion towards Black farmers when Biden first got into office. They put $5 billion, and then a lot of you know, white farmers, they got mad and they put a lawsuit, and that money went right back to them. So they put $5 billion for Black farmers, and then they took it back and gave it back to the 95% of it. They gave it back to the same farmers that don't need that much money.
Okay. Well, see, this is the kind of stuff that, you know, the more we talk about it, we've got to be able to talk about it. And it's uncomfortable to talk about sometimes, but it's the reality. Numbers don't lie, you mm-hmm. know? And this is where we've got to be able to say that I understand that we may not feel that this is what's happening or going on, but it's a topic that we've got to be able to address. And so, yeah, I welcome you to talk anytime. I'm really excited. We scheduled another interview on the 26th where we're going to have a panel of farmers to kind of answer and dive into some of these questions. And I really would like to dive in too, to the farm experience, right? Let's talk about some of the education for those farmers specifically. And any questions or anything that you want to throw out? I had one other question I wanted to get to. What was your most innovative thing you saw when you were at NoCo? And what was the best, like, what did you see and experience in the positive light of our industry's growth?
Just the diversity that was in that room, all the different faces, all the different people, and everybody's like, you know, just there for the same common goal. It was one of the most, I enjoyed myself in this conference more than any other conference that I've been to. You know, my first conference was the Expo, the Cannabis Expo in New York City at the Javits Center. And, you know, I'm a smoker, I smoke weed. So I smoked before I went in. You know, it's a cannabis expo. You're supposed to, you know, use weed. And then when people were walking by, one guy looked at me and he said, "Everybody that smoke weed want to be in the industry." I was like, if you're not smoking, I mean, what are you saying? Like, what are you talking about? So for me, I felt the love. And to me, it was the hempwood. Hempwood, my father's a builder. So my father's into construction.
Awesome.
So they gave me a sample of the hempwood for the flooring. And I showed it to my father. He was like, you need to grow hemp for this.
You sold him.
Yeah, I sold him already. He's like, you need to grow it. This is beautiful. Look at the finish. So to me, it was like seeing the hempwood flooring and the things that you can do with it. I never seen that. So that was, for me, that was like the
I'm going to show you something. You can keep talking, but I'm going to go get something for you that Aaron made out of hempwood for me that I think you'll
take. But for me, that was that. That was like the most interesting thing that I saw.
Look at this rolling tray.
Yes, I saw that.
Isn't that so cool?
Yes. The finish is so crazy.
What?
The finish of it is so crazy.
It's so cool, huh?
Yeah. So yeah. To me, that was like the coolest thing I saw there. So I was very impressed by the work that they are doing. I know they are working with Peter and you guys for the tiny hemp house that you guys are putting together.
Man, Greg has done an incredible job, and Aaron. Aaron does a lot of the finish work and stuff like this, but Greg's done an incredible job at building partnerships and distribution mm-hmm. channels, and the awareness is becoming more and more. He's got some great stories about challenges, obviously, but remembering we're at the forefront of an industry. And so he's just done a really good job at setting business up and facilitating.
Yeah, I mean, my father, you know, they old school, so they don't, in Dominicans, they rather use, like, I'm gonna give you a hint, a little jewel about Dominican culture. They'd rather you be an alcoholic than smoke weed. So it was a lot of work to get my parents to the stage that that they are in right now.
It took something like this.
So when I showed him that, he was like, I'm sold. Now I know why you're growing it. So I'm
that's a story. Like that right there is like, because I always ask people, like, what's your aha moment? You're like, oh, I showed my dad a piece of hemp wood.
Yeah, now he wants to build with it. You know, he does a lot of projects in his house. So now he wants to, you know, get this material himself.
That's so cool. It's awesome. There's lots of opportunity and lots of growth. It's always fascinating. So if you're, we're at an hour, so I'm going to ask one more question and then we'll be done. When you grow industrial, you know, like fiber, what is your end application? You know, what are you hoping to sell into?
I just want to get a decorticator that breaks everything apart and sell that.
Okay, so you want to do raw materials?
The raw materials. Just sell the raw materials and let the manufacturers do what they do. That's my dream. You know, just process it, the raw material, and that's what we're doing with the CBD. Is that we grow the flower just for raw oil, CBD oil, and then we give it to the manufacturers and they do whatever they do with it. We don't want nothing else to do. And sequester the carbon. I want to sequester carbon and get some carbon credits for the farm, you know.
I had a really good interview last week. Jamie Bentley, I think is his last name. You'll have to look him up. Unite Capital. He's got some really good numbers that he shared about carbon sequestration and what it looks like, you know, because most of it, he said, is below soil and 40% of it is above ground, which was pretty impactful because hemp has a lot above ground. So that's even cooler. Yeah. You know, and that's hard numbers. You can see how much hemp's grown, and when a bale weighs 2,000 pounds, 40% of that, for example, or 45% is carbon. And that's just pretty cool to realize, right? But we're out of time. I could keep talking to you for a long time and keep going. We'll have you back. For anybody that's listening, please come back on May 26th. I'm not sure where August came from. May 26th.
That's my birthday, August 1st.
It is? Okay. Mine's on Thursday.
Okay. Happy birthday.
I'll be 29.
Okay.
Happy birthday. For 11 years. Whatever. Okay, so I want to say goodbye real quick to Drew. I saw Drew was on just a minute ago. James, Alejandro, Wayne, and Patrick, thank you very much for saying hello and chiming in today. Anything that you need, Hector, yell at us. I'm happy to support and chime in. I'd love to continue to collaborate. I will send information over that we talked about earlier as soon as I get it, and so we can get you lined up with even more resources. For anybody else that has questions, do what Hector said and join GHA.
That's right.
We're all about supporting and collaborating. And then also, I know that I showed you my shirt a little bit earlier. These are the shirts that we have, partnership with Global Hemp Association and Friends of Hemp. And they'll be on our website for sale. But they are hemp clothes or hemp t-shirts. So they're pretty dope.
Yeah. I love them.
Yes. I saw Ray had one on the other day and sent me a picture. I'll have to share it on social media so that you can see it. It's awesome.
Okay.
It's awesome. Anyways, thank you very, very much.
And follow us on Cimarron Farmstead on Instagram.
Say that again.
Follow us on Cimarron Farm, Cimarron Farmstead on Instagram.
Yes. Okay. I like that. Absolutely. Thank you. And feel free, you can get in the chat on social and make comments or anything like that as well. And then if anybody has any questions, how do people reach out to you? On Instagram?
Email, cimarronfarms@gmail.com. On the Instagram. We don't have a website yet. We're working on it. On LinkedIn. So I'm on LinkedIn as well. Hector Gerardo, you can find me there.
Perfect. You're awesome. Okay, well, thank you very much. See everybody.